Hi, my name is Kevin McDonald, and I'm declaring my independence. Independence from what? Why, negative thoughts and energy, of course. Chief among them, hate, division, and fear. You see, I know that we're all one, and together we can solve any problem, save our planet and each other. Please, join me as we come together as one and choose a better way to be. So now, let's begin with my independence report. And welcome to my independence report, and it is a Tuesday. It's St. Patty's Day. It's the 17th of March, and I know that I'm not supposed to be here behind the microphone. I'm supposed to be in a hospital having a surgery done, and that's been, for obvious reasons, has been canceled. So I thought that I would come here today and try and brighten everybody's mood a little bit if we can. So I invited one of my favorite people on the planet. Her name is Brandy M. Miller. She is a motivational coach, a very positive person, and we thought we'd get together with you for this hour. However long it takes to talk about the current situation that we find ourselves in and ways that we can make ourselves a little bit better. So with that, I'm going to invite Brandy to come on. Brandy, how are you?
I am good, Kevin. I am so good. And yes, it is St. Patrick's Day. There will be no parades today. Bars are closed.
That's the point. They picked a fine day to go ahead and close bars, don't you think?
Yeah, they did, and I'm sure it's killing some of the people out there, especially those who are running bars and who do make their living that way. So it's a good time to bring some positivity to what could be a very negative situation in many people's lives.
It really is, and we were talking right before we came on air, and we were talking about the current situation, and it is really a difficult time for everybody at the moment. And we are just in the beginning of it and don't know how far it's going to get. And I think there's a lot of people that are really, really, really scared and frightened by it. I'm in Seattle, which is the quote-unquote epicenter, and you are in mm-hmm. Dallas.
Yes, I am.
But even in Dallas, there's lots of issues going on.
Yeah, we've had 19 cases pop up in Dallas that were confirmed. Two of them were at a country club. So, you know, the rich aren't immune, just so you know. and there's all kinds of, our sports teams, Dallas Cowboys, the NHL, there's no school, there's no just about anything that has to do with gatherings of 50 or more people. And I think that can kind of scare people.
Oh, yeah.
Because the change is so dramatic. I mean, it looked like the zombie apocalypse had hit when I walked into the grocery stores yesterday looking for toilet paper.
Tell us that story.
Standing in, my husband and I, heard about, of course, the toilet paper run, but I guess that's kind of in denial. Plus, one of our invoices hadn't gotten paid, and so we didn't really have the money to stock up early. So anyway, got paid, went looking, 6 grocery stores, 6. Completely wiped out of paper products and toilet paper. And one of them, the line put to the checkout was from the checkout counter all the way to the meat counter in the back of the store. And this was Kroger, so it's not a tiny store.
it's a big deal.
Wow. Yeah.
Yeah, I saw a film of at a Costco, and people had their carts, and they were lined up. It was like they were snaked through the entire parking lot mm-hmm. to try and get into the store because they were only allowing so many people so that people could have spacing mm-hmm. and stuff. So it's crazy. It's wild. We have never seen, I'm 62, and I would never seen anything close to what this is going to end up being.
No, I haven't seen anything like this. I'm 44, but I don't remember seeing anything like this in my entire lifetime. Now, I am told, and the weird part is having masses canceled. I'm Catholic, so mass is everything.
Oh,
and
sure.
To have masses canceled, every mass, not just Sunday mass, but every mass is canceled. It just feels wrong on a lot of levels. But I am told that they did do something similar in the 1970 when there was another pandemic, not of this level. But it's not an experience I've ever had.
Well, I even heard that the things that you go to church for, like to go to confession and stuff, that was even closed.
Confessions were still open because they're one-on-one with the priest. So it's not like you're in a giant cluster. Although they are recommending that if people 70 or older are meeting in groups, they not meet in groups larger than 10. Like if your group is 10 or more, you're not supposed to meet at all.
Well, and it's when you're older, when you're, you know, in your 60s, I'm in the demographic of people that are really need to be careful. And yeah. You know, the interesting thing is there are young people that say, well, you know, I'm not going to worry about it because it only affects old people. Well, if you are not careful, you could give that to your mother, to your grandmother, mm-hmm. and that could be the end of their life. So you,
well, what they're not thinking about is that it's not just the elderly; it's anybody who's immunocompromised. That means anybody who's on birth control, because birth control is a natural immune suppressant. That means anybody who's morbidly obese, which means you're over 25% body fat. That means anybody who's got asthma.
Yeah.
Anybody who's got, say, Crohn's disease, or is on a medicine that suppresses the immune system for any reason. This is not just about protecting the elderly. 60% of our population have issues that place them in the category of immunocompromised.
That kind of sucks.
Yeah, I mean, to put it into perspective, it's easy to say, well, it's just the elderly. Of course, elderly make up 25% of our population. So imagine going from 330 million Americans and losing a quarter of that number.
You know, I was listening yesterday. I'm kind of a numbers guy, so I follow mm-hmm. the numbers as people talk about them. And Governor Cuomo, the New York governor, mm-hmm. was talking about what's going on in Italy. And strangely enough, our curve is going right along where Italy was. We're just a couple of weeks behind it.
And yeah, we are.
And he was saying that... according to the chancellor of Germany, that she thinks 60% of the population is going to get this, and 17% mm-hmm. of that 60% of the population end up in the hospital. And yeah. the problem is that if 60%, so I did the math, based on 330 mm-hmm. million people, we're in deep trouble because we're going to be in... We don't have anywhere near the hospital beds. We don't have the respirators. Mm-hmm. We don't have any of that stuff. And there are people that are literally going to be dying in the streets, I'm afraid.
It's a possibility. And the other part of it is, think about it. That's only those people that are affected by coronavirus.
That right.
doesn't include those who might be hit by a car, who might be having a heart attack, who might, you know, have some other illness that just happens to afflict them.
Yeah, you're right. All right. So
what it means is that the whole hospital system can shut down.
Okay. So we've decided then that we got a problem. But Brandy, you're a motivational coach. You're a positive
Absolutely
person.
Absolutely, I am.
How do we get through this?
Well, we get through this by using the best resources we can. For instance, if your family can afford to buy a stethoscope, buy a blood pressure cuff, buy a thermometer, use the basic tools, because I have a feeling a lot of medicine is going to go virtual. Like a lot of doctor's visits are going to be virtual in order to protect everybody, right? So get yourself the basic tools that a nurse's unit or a hospital would use to diagnose and treat, right? And keep those at hand. And then go on YouTube and learn how to use them. Because God knows there's a video for everything on YouTube.
That's true.
You know, here's another thing. If food is running out in your area, Mother Nature is abundantly providing for us. We just have to know what we're looking for. Dandelions, for instance, are a great source of nutrients. You can make tea with their roots. You can make wine with their roots. The leaves and the flowers can actually be eaten. They're entirely edible, and they're very, very good for you. Learn the natural herbs and the natural plants that you can eat to sustain yourself. There's always an answer. Be generous when you're most afraid to be generous. That's when you need to be most generous. Generosity is actually a long-term survival strategy, and our short-term survival mechanisms in the brain will fight that long-term survival tendency, but it's the best strategy. When you're generous, the universe is programmed to reward generosity with generosity. The more seeds a farmer plants, the more fruit he harvests. You have to think about service to others like seeds in the ground. You're planting every time you serve somebody else. Even when you think you don't have it to give, and you give, you're actually planting seeds that will come back to you.
That's kind of the law of attraction. That's a form of that, right?
In a sense, yeah. I mean, it's kind of like it's tapping into the world's tendency to reward generosity with abundance.
Yeah.
The more generous you are, the more generously you receive.
You know what frightens me a little bit is that, and we talked about this the other day, is that because our society is so fragmented, not only do we have people mm-hmm. on the left and people on the right that can't seem to get along, but we've also got the social media thing where everybody kind of hunkers down mm-hmm. We've lost our sense of community.
And this is not going to help it. You know, the social distancing measures aren't going to help that in the short term.
No.
But they are important to respect, and they are important to follow along with. In the meanwhile, use social media like it's intended and develop those communities. You know, leverage it. Gather in groups with people you can't connect with otherwise. Keep in touch with your family. Keep in touch with your friends. Make sure you're checking up on them. Because you never know when somebody might need help. And even if you can't reach them, if you can connect with somebody who lives near them who can reach them, then you'll feel a lot better, and so will they.
Well, we were talking about, you know, even something as simple as if you have, you know, you have a neighbor who lives alone and they are mm-hmm. older and they're elderly, and just to check on them. Just to say, mm-hmm. how are you? You don't have to go in their house. You can just knock on the door and just say checking to make sure that that you're okay. Because we need to reestablish our sense of community, that we're all one and we're all in this together. And together mm-hmm. we'll get out of it. But we're mm-hmm. if we are going to hunker down in our own space, and it's going to be very difficult for us to get together, to work together, to help meet everybody's needs. I'll give you a perfect example is that you had to go to 6 stores to find toilet paper. There are people in our community that have a basement full of toilet paper, I'm convinced.
Oh, well, there were stories about that. Part of the reason why we have a toilet paper shortage is that there were people who decided that this was a great time to go to stores, buy out all their stock, and then list it on eBay and Amazon for 10 to 20 times what it was worth.
And that is just, that's just a crime. And those people, honestly,
actually, it literally is a crime, and they are now facing some criminal charges for their behavior, not to mention having a garage full of supplies they can no longer use.
And there, I saw a report where somebody was, they bought a bunch of hand sanitizer and mm-hmm. were selling it, and they had made like $100,000 worth of profit on their neighbors in mm-hmm. the United States. And
the worst one I read about was a guy who bought it for $1 a bottle of hand sanitizer and sold it to hospitals for $16.
Wow. And those are people who live here. Those are our neighbors.
Yeah.
And then, well, you know
what? Yeah. Crisis brings out 2 things. It'll bring out the best in some people, and it'll bring out the worst in others. That's a reality. That's human nature. But this is an opportunity for us to become the best version of ourselves. You know, nobody grows really well in the comfort zone. And truthfully, America has been very comfortable for way too long. yes, this is scary, but this is also an opportunity for us to grow and to rise up and to realize that we have more in us than we think we do. But we're capable of doing more than we realize we're capable of doing. And that we're capable of caring for one another more than we thought we could.
I tend to think, this is just my own opinion, and I would be interested in your opinion, but I think that this, what's going on now is going to be a cataclysmic thing that is going to change how we fundamentally operate in this country. Because it's
I totally agree.
It's clear that our healthcare system is not going to be able to survive this and be able to come through it because they don't have enough equipment, don't have enough beds. So we're going to have to change the healthcare system. We're going to have to change virtually everything that we do and how we do it. Except maybe mm-hmm. we'll wipe our butt because we don't have any toilet paper. But
well, there's leaves for that. Just be careful of the poison ivy and the poison.
Well, exactly.
Sumac.
Well, you know, and the reality is, my mother who went through the Great Depression in the 30s, they used the Sears catalog. Well, you know, mm-hmm. you do what you got to do, and
well, there are books that aren't very good, and some of those might well make efficient toilet paper.
Well, there are, but there is one book that is really good, and that's your book, which Turning Problems into Profits.
Yes, actually, it's a very timely book. You know, I didn't even realize when I was releasing it in November how timely this would be. But it is. It's about taking your past problems, the things that you take for granted and overlook because now it's so easy for you to solve. And use those as tools that you can use to help somebody else solve a problem that they're confronting and don't know how to get past. But for instance, your mother, having gone through the Great Depression, she has lots of solutions that they came up with that you don't know about. And every one of those is valuable to people who this is the first time through for them.
Oh, sure. Oh, sure. Well, they raised chickens and they lived in Seattle. Within the city mm-hmm. limits, but they raised chickens and they raised their own vegetables mm-hmm. and that sort of thing because you had to in those days.
Well, and that's something that people can do too. I mean, even if you're living in an apartment like I am, take 2-liter bottles and turn them into small gardens. Take plastic disposable cups and use those to start growing plants because everything you start growing today, 60 to 90 days, can become food for your table. You know, you have solutions available to you. You just need to be looking for them and thinking about them and sharing them online. You know, reach out and share what you figured out.
Now, in your world, you operate online. Your business mm-hmm. is online a lot because you're
primarily, yeah.
It's mostly worldwide, isn't your business?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I've had clients in Singapore and Australia and England and all kinds of places, Canada, too, and of course in the United States. Ironically, a lot of my clients are minorities.
Oh, really?
So, yeah, mm-hmm. Most of my clients, about 75% of my clients are minorities.
And what exactly, when you say they're your clients, what exactly are they coming to you for?
Well, in the beginning, it was mostly just to get help writing their books, because I really, at that time, my mindset was that, you know, it was just focused on the book. I didn't really see the real power of writing. And I think most of us in America don't actually understand how powerful writing really is. It's a tool for problem solving. Because every book starts with a problem, even when it's fiction, right? It starts with a problem. And midway through the book, you find this solution. And then the rest of the book is about you implementing that solution and the results that come from that.
So
in this day and time, we need more problem solvers. So we need more people stepping up to write because we need people thinking through problems.
So I'm curious to know, in the current situation that we find ourselves, what if this was a fictional piece that you were going to work on, how would it end?
Well, it ends with the world having been transformed and strengthened. We get the end of the old world, and that's the frightening part, right? Any time in the that life is going to build something, right? If you have this, let's say you're a builder and you buy this plot of land and it has this shack on it, and the shack is run down and it's kind of dilapidated and there's all kinds of junk on the land and, you know, broken down cars and stuff from the last person who lived there. What would be the first thing that you would have to do before you could build anything on that land?
You'd have to tear it down.
You'd have to tear everything down. You'd have to totally level it to the ground, right?
Yep.
Everything would have to go. That's what happens when you're about to hit something new. There's this period of massive destruction that sweeps in, and it's frightening. And you try your best to hold on to the shack, right? Because that's what you know and that's what's comfortable.
Yep. That's where your bed is.
That's not where you need to live. So the harder you try to hold on to that shack and the harder you try to get back to what was safe and comfortable, the longer this process of destruction takes.
Wow. That's a good point.
When the destruction is done, there's a period of construction. The construction is messy and it's frustrating because you can just catch this bare glimmer of what's ahead and waiting for you, but you can't quite get there. Right? You can start to see, you can see the walls coming up. You can see the blueprint taking shape. You can see the vision is starting to form, but it's not quite there. And then when you're done with that, well, there's the move-in day, right? And everything's built, construction's finally thing, and then you gotta move in and you gotta decorate the place and you gotta furnish it and you gotta. So there's always gonna be change happening. But what we're about to see now is that destruction phase that has to come before a better world can be built.
Well, you know, did you ever see the movie Armageddon?
Mm-mm.
It was a movie about the space aliens who came and attacked us. And what I liked about that was it created a common enemy. And mm-hmm. it became a worldwide phenomenon that we had no choice as a species. We had to either unite or die.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, well, and that's kind of going to be what I think is going to happen in very shortly. We're going to find that we either have to come together or we won't make it through. This is not going to be something where we can isolate ourselves and make it. We're either going to have to work together and pull forward or we're going to lose it all. And that's our choice. But I'm hopeful that people will choose to work together. In fact, right now, our society has been divided, but I think that's partially because we had room to be divided. You know, when you get comfortable, it's easy to say, I don't need this person, I don't need this person, I don't need this person, I don't need that person. But when you're in a crisis, you need every hand on deck. You can't afford to chase off anybody.
I know, I agree. And you know, I think that we are in that place. Of where it's, we are going to go through some really, really tough times. But if we work together and stay together and be positive and work as a community, we can come out the other side. Those of us that are still here, we can come out the other side and do some great things. I really,
oh, absolutely.
I love your attitude about that.
Well, I mean, it comes from experience. You know, my life has been pretty much lived in the rough, and I'll have periods where I move ahead a little and things look good, and then they would slip back down and I would start. I've literally can't count the number of times I had to leave everything behind and start over from scratch, you know. But every time I realized when that happened, when the dust cleared and everything was settled, I realized I'd come out better for it. Like things were better than they were before.
Yes, indeed. Yes, indeed. Now, by the way, I just got reprimanded by a listener who said that, and they're right. It was actually Independence Day, which really worked for them on this podcast. So it's Independence Day, where Armageddon was another one where the asteroid was going to destroy the Earth, but we still had to get together. Either way,
those stories are all about where we have to rebuild. because something is coming together where we have to decide to put aside our differences and let's get together and do what we do best, which is innovate and solve problems.
Absolutely. Because we're going to be put into a position where we really have no choice. We have to solve them, and we can. But it's going to take a lot.
Well, it is going to take a lot, but it's also, like I said, it's going to be a period where it feels really scary and where it feels like we're losing everything because we are losing everything we know. But what's ahead after you lose everything is always something better. Always.
That's a really cool thing. By the way, if you're listening and would like to join in on the conversation, you can do that. Just click the call in button and I'll bring you online and you can talk and ask Brandy a question or two. And she's our guest today. And Brandy M. Miller, she is a motivational speaker and author. And she really has a worldwide business and a wonderful philosophy. I love your philosophy of life because it is, I think, there is the other thing that's going on is that the division, hate, division, and fear are going to end up dying. I really believe that we are going to come out of this with a much better sense of who we are as far as being positive rather than utilizing hate, division, and fear, which some people still do to get what they want.
Well, there's okay. We're still going to be human at the end of this. That's the reality. And as long as we're human, there's going to be part of us who will not rise to the occasion, who will choose the short-term gain of selfishness. That's reality. But I think the majority of us can choose to do better. You know, the majority of us have the desire for better. And we'll choose to do better. And you can't get rid of human nature, but you can tame your own. You can't change the people around you, but you can change yourself. That's where it starts.
Brandy, give us some tools to how to do that.
One of the things is to remember that 99% of what other people do has nothing to do with you.
Yeah, but that takes,
it looks like they're intentionally hurting you, it's not really about you.
But they're taking that takes away all the drama.
Exactly. It does. But it took me a long time to get to this place where I realized that 99% of how somebody reacts, even when it looks like they're reacting to me, isn't about me. It's about them dealing with their own struggle, their own pain, and not choosing the best method to handle it. And when I realize that I don't always choose the best method to handle the situations I'm going through, then it's easier to be a little more forgiving. I usually use three questions to help me whenever I've encountered somebody who hurt me so that I don't return hurt for hurt. And the first question is, when have I done something similar to somebody else and why? So that I can kind of put myself in their headspace and maybe see where they're coming from. The second question is, when have I done something like that to myself and why? Which is sometimes a little easier to see. It's like, you know, if you've been abused by somebody, it's hard to see, well, I don't think I've abused anybody else until you look at how you're abusing yourself. Oh, okay. Well, now I see. And then the third question is for me, because, you know, God is my number one, is when have I done this to God? And that's a lot easier to see.
Well, but no, now, Brandy, let's be real here. What you're asking of people with those three questions is for them to actually be honest with themselves.
It's true, but I find, okay, denial is this really big river that runs through the state of confusion. And everybody takes a dip in that river from time to time, okay? But it's never a good idea to go out there and build a houseboat and live on denial. Never. Because the waters of denial hide the crocodile. You don't want to meet the crocodile. Crocodile comes when you're comfortable and lazy and you think everything's covered. And then it snatches you right off that boat.
Yep.
The truth is the shore. The truth is the safe place to be, but it doesn't look as comfortable or easy. That's which is why we sometimes choose to stay on the river denial long past the point where we should have embraced the truth.
How do we convince ourselves to get out of the river, out of the of denial, and face the truth? Because most of us really don't want to face the truth.
Well, it's true. Ironically, it is true that it is hard to face the truth. But if we realize that in the truth is freedom from fear, then it becomes a little easier. Once you have actually embraced the truth, there is no need to fear.
One of my favorite acronyms for fear, you know what that is, don't you?
False evidence appearing real.
Hey, you're so good. You knew that. False evidence appearing real, because there, if you live your life in a certain way, there is no fear, because everything is by design, and it's going to work out just perfectly however it suited. Let me give you an example. I am when I started this podcast in August, I wanted to grow it and to really make a difference, and that's why in the beginning it says that I'm declaring my independence from hate, division, and fear. And so many things have happened throughout the fall. I was able to move into a place that I'm going to retire at and spend the rest of my life, and it was much cheaper. It kind of fell into my lap, and then I fell on the property and hurt my shoulder. And so I'm not able to work. So I'm able to do this. And, and then the virus hit and, my surgery gets canceled. And so now I'm really quite not able to work, but that's why I believe honestly and truly that I believe the universe has set it up for me to do this. And that's why that's why they have reacted the way, or they responded the way that they have, is so that I could do this and to hopefully bring light to the world and to bring people like you onto the stage, so that a grander stage, so that people can understand what we can actually have if we choose to.
Yeah, absolutely. And we can choose. We have every day the choice. How we respond to fear. It's not that fear has no use. Every emotion we experience is there for a positive purpose. Fear exists for a positive purpose. Fear exists to protect us from harm. I say that fear is a small mouse that sits on your shoulder, and its job is to watch for danger. And if you listen to fear, you can plan, you can make plans, you can prepare, and you can avoid the danger. If you ignore fear, it will continue to eat at your ear until you're just gnawing away your life with nothing but fear, because you would not confront it. But don't let fear in the driver's seat, because it is nothing but a small mouse, and it will wreck your life if you let it in the driver's seat, because it doesn't know how to drive. So don't let it control your life, right?
Right.
That's the mistake. Every emotion that we feel, all negative emotions, have a positive point to them. Anger is there to help us spot injustice. When it sees an injustice, it points to it. If we pay attention to the injustice and we correct it, the anger goes away and goes back to work. Right? If we don't pay attention to it, that's when we bottle it up and we become explosive.
Right.
Okay, so all the emotions that we feel have something to say to us. We just need to know what they're trying to tell us, and then we need to address it. That's all. But what we mostly are trained to do is either ignore them, bottle them up, or shove them, compartmentalize and shove them to the side. So we don't get the information they're trying to tell us early enough to do something about the situation before it becomes critical.
Interesting. It's very rare that somebody can make me think while I'm doing this so much that I forget to talk. But that's because that's something that I really do a pretty good job of talking. But that was I'm fascinated with because obviously you've thought about this quite a little bit.
Oh yeah, well I have to. I'm a very analytical nature. And so everything that happens, I think about it. Why does it happen? Why did it work this way and not that way? And as I was in the process of writing and teaching people how to write, well, part of what you have to do is be able to capture emotion and to understand what triggers emotion. Why do we react this way and not that way? And then I started to realize that every emotion had something to tell us. It was just what it was telling us. Usually we're not listening. Usually we don't want to hear it because we don't want to feel it. Because we don't like our negative emotions. They make us feel bad. Right. We don't want them there. But if we will allow them to be experienced, we will find that they have something positive to point to us, that we can pinpoint what the problem is. And if we can pinpoint it, we can address it. And if we can address it, we can change it.
Now, in your work, teaching people how to write, it really is that the whole process that you're just describing is a really an analytical process that you, I'm assuming, put your students through so that they can learn how to write more effectively. Was that?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, it's part of it. You have to be able to sit there and in order to write effectively, even if you're writing nonfiction. If you're writing nonfiction, the biggest obstacle to somebody getting something done isn't the instruction part. It's the mindset. It's the fear they have that they won't be able to do it. It's the worry they have that they don't have what it takes. If you can't get them past those obstacles, you won't be able to get them to the completion point where they can then leave a wonderful review about how great the work was.
How do you get them to get through that fear?
Well, like I said, teach them what fear is, you know, that it's okay to be afraid. It's okay to be afraid the first time you do something. It's also okay to fail. Failure is a teaching moment. If you try something and you fail, it's okay. This is one of the things we don't teach kids. In fact, by the time they get to elementary school, they become terrified of failure. But it is okay to fail. Failure is part of the learning process. If you're not failing, it's because you're not trying. Think about how often a child falls before they learn to walk. You know, and then even when they learn to walk, they don't master it right away. When they learn to run, they don't master it right away. You know, we are so gentle with kids who are trying to do new things from the time that they're born until about the time they're 3 or 4. And then after that, we're like, well, why can't you do this? Well, because they're still learning. And it takes about 1,000 times of failing something before you get it right.
You know, what's interesting is that we're talking about the current crisis that we are in and that Major League Baseball and the spring training is closed and stuff. And I was just thinking, you know, as far as even the best major league hitters, they fail 7 out of 10 times.
Exactly. I mean, have you ever known anybody to have 100% batting average?
Nobody has.
Exactly. And that's because, you know, failure is, well, for one thing, you learn a lot more from failure usually than you do from success.
That's true.
Yeah, the greatest danger is actually in you succeeding too early, too soon, and too much. I believe that's one of the reasons why kids who have it easy in elementary school and who get straight A's without much effort are actually positioned for failure as adults.
You're right.
Because what it does to them is train them to think that failure is abnormal, that there's something wrong if they're not able to master everything quickly and easily. If kids are getting straight A's, we should really be thinking about that because they shouldn't be.
That's
true. They're not being challenged enough.
Yep.
If they're getting straight A's, it's because nobody's challenging them enough.
And kids, everybody needs to be challenged in order to reach their full potential.
Absolutely. And that's actually why the universe will set up challenges for humanity.
I get the big... I get the biggest kick out of that, the way that they operate, because the folks on the other side, they know what you can take, what you can handle, but they put it just a little bit outside of your comfort zone so that you have to reach for it.
Right. Well, what do we do with the kids when they're learning to walk, right? Mom and dad will step away about 2 feet from the kid, which is probably about a foot more than the kid can actually get to, and say, come on, you can do it. And so the kid has to work to get to mom and dad. They can see their goal. They can anticipate their goal. But they're not quite able to get there yet until they keep trying. And we should be cheering on one another on like that, too. If our society would do that, would recognize that people who are failing are not failures. They're people in need of encouragement. And we surround them and rally around them and go, come on, you can do it. You can do it. I see you trying. Come on, get up. It's okay. You fell. It's okay. If we would be more like that, I think everybody would have a better experience.
Well, and in our current situation that we find ourselves, we are going to have to make some of those changes, because we are on the cusp of something that is going to require us to do some major changes, don't you think?
Oh, I do. I think we're around the cusp of it more ways than one. I think the virus is predominant in our thoughts right now, but there's a financial undertow going on right now. And I think that when that catches up to us, we can find ourselves going into a economic spiral that goes downward if we don't take steps now to stop it, or we can find ourselves learning to swim in a new way. I was talking to a guy who's in real estate investment yesterday, and he's like, oh, real estate's always secure. He's like, no, everybody's always going to need a house. I'm like, well, yeah, everybody needs a house, but they'll build shanty towns if they can't afford the housing you've got. And that's true. He's like, real estate's always a selfish investment. Well, no, actually, he's wrong, in my opinion. Human beings are always your safest investment.
Oh, that's true. Well, I was thinking about that as far as the real estate goes, because right now, real estate is a good investment. However, if people can't work, if you are sequestered to your house and there are people that are going to be in real deep doo-doo because they have trouble paying their mortgage as it is, and they're working. If they're not working, they can't pay their mortgage. The government can support it for a little bit, but what's going to happen is people are no longer going to be able to buy houses at the current valuation, so the valuation of the houses is going to go down, and it's going to be like 2008 all over again.
Or worse, yeah, or worse, because the banks may not have the money to lend. Like I said, Deutsche Bank is trading right now at around $5.40 a share, and that's one of the major banks in Europe. It's the predominant bank in Germany, and if it goes down, it's likely to take the European Union with it, and other banks along with it. And so there may not be money to lend. There may not be money floating around like there is now, but we don't have to have that scenario happen. If the people who have, and there's like, somebody did a survey, there's like 25,000 Americans or more with self-directed, not 25,000, but 25 million Americans with like self-directed IRAs that are sitting in accounts doing nothing, earning no interest for them.
Right.
If they would take that money and invest it in underdeveloped human beings, then they can get not only a return on their investment financially, but an emotional return on their investment and help prevent the collapse of the economy. We don't have to have the tidal wave of collapse. We can choose to change, but the time is now if we're going to do it.
You're right. If we are going to make those changes, I mean, what the universe likes to do is, when it's time for us to make a change, you're going to have the opportunity to change, or they're going to make you change.
Right, exactly.
And then we just get to choose how we are going to change to make it better for everybody.
Right, exactly.
But,
and so, you know, there are people with money who can right now choose to invest that money in developing some of these underdeveloped human beings. And if you don't know how to do that, my guide will teach you. I mean, it's literally step-by-step instructions to follow to get them to the point where they can make that money. You know, invest that money in people who are underdeveloped, you know, people who are laid off. There are pilots right now who are laid off. There are restaurant workers who are laid off. There are all kinds of people who are out of a job and need help. And these are not lazy, shiftless people. These are people who have not reached their full potential yet.
Right. And is that, do you think it's because they're lazy or is it just that No. they lack the opportunity?
I don't know that everybody has opportunity and this is, but it's hard to see when you're not trained to spot opportunity for what it is. And most opportunity, they say opportunity only knocks once, and that's absolutely not true.
I agree with that.
Opportunity comes wrapped in the most disgusting, nasty packages possible. It comes wrapped as problems. And the bigger the problem, the greater the opportunity. And usually what we look at is we don't want those problems, so we push away opportunities because we don't want the smelly, nasty wrapping paper, and we think it's nasty. So it's like, oh, I don't want this problem. I want it to go away. And of course, it keeps coming back because we won't deal with it.
Are we scared of the opportunity sometimes? Are we scared of success?
Well, I know I have been scared of success because the thought is that, okay, if I succeed, people will expect things of me. And what if I can't live up to what they expect? But on the flip side of that coin is who am I letting down because I'm not stepping up? Who am I disappointing because I had something that could help them and I chose not to step up?
That's something to think about right there. Because
exactly.
We all have our own gifts that we mm-hmm. can put out there and to help humanity, to help each other. And if you just decide to hide those gifts, then you're not only defeating yourself, you're defeating the people around you and the people who you could help.
Exactly. Well, it took me a while to work through that, but the realization came that by choosing not to step up, I was choosing to allow people that I could help to suffer when they didn't need to.
Wow. That puts it into a whole different perspective.
It does. You see, this world is a jigsaw puzzle, and each of us is a piece of that puzzle. Now, some people come into this world and they're the sharp corners, so it's really easy to identify where they belong. And they get to their maximum potential quickly because it's easier for them, right? You know exactly where to put them. You know exactly what they do and how they function. It's clear. And then some people are the side pieces, and they have one side figured out, and the rest of them, maybe it's a little tougher to figure out where they fit into the overall picture. The rest of us, though, 99% of us, are that messy middle. You know, we're the pieces that you pick up and you're like, what in the heck was the person who made this piece thinking? And you're trying all over the place. You're fitting them with this thing and it doesn't work. You're fitting them with that thing and it doesn't work. You're trying here, you're trying there. Nothing on them makes sense until they're fitted into the right community. And then their pieces snap in place and everything makes this beautiful, perfect sense for why they are the way they are. So for people who are listening who might be in that messy middle and they haven't figured themselves out yet, there's hope. But you won't figure it out alone because that piece is not designed to work alone. None of us are. We're designed to fit into a community.
How do you teach people to shut up and listen to their inner soul, their inner self, so that they can reach their overall potential?
I write. That's how I do it. I write out my thoughts. I write out my feelings. And then I sit back and I analyze. What am I thinking? What am I feeling? And why? You know, why did this come out on the page? And a lot of times it's during my writing that I come to these aha moments of realization. It's kind of the way my subconscious pours out its garbage on the page, and then I'll sort through and look at it and notice the pattern and notice the trend and go, oh, okay, that makes sense. This is connected to this.
Now, I wanted to ask you, in your writing, who you are, do you sometimes feel like that you are kind of channeling somebody else when you are putting pen to paper?
Oh, absolutely. Well, I personally believe that no fiction writer is really writing their own story. It's not your story. You're just the pen the person picked to tell their story.
Uh-huh.
And, you know, and you're picked because of who you are. Like, you're picked specifically for a reason, that you have certain qualities that will allow that person's story to come through better than it would come through for somebody else. Like, you're the person to represent it. But, you know, I know we're not talking religion, and I'm not asking anybody to believe in the Bible at all. But a perfect example of this is the story in the Bible of Moses, right? Well, he was picked for a reason. He didn't know the reason. He didn't understand why God picked him specifically to speak to Pharaoh. But if you look at his background, he was objecting, look, I have a stutter. You know, I can't speak well. I'm embarrassed to speak in public. Please pick somebody else. For the love of all, holy, please pick somebody else. And a lot of times we do the same thing. But in reality, Moses wasn't looking at his background and history to understand why God would want him instead of somebody else. See, Moses was raised by Pharaoh's daughter in the courts, right? And every mother loves her child. And I guarantee you, Pharaoh's daughter would have done everything in her power to fix his stutter. She would have called on every court magician, every philosopher, every person, every expert she could have gotten in touch with to come fix her child. And nobody could do it. So if Moses had then walked into the court and opened his mouth and the speech was clear and eloquent, that would have been a sign in and of itself that there was something divine going on, something bigger than everybody else, right? But instead, he let Aaron do the talking for him. Well, Aaron didn't have the same background. Aaron didn't have the same context. Nobody knew Aaron. So it was just some smooth-talking guy. Didn't have the same impact. So the pen that's chosen is chosen for a specific reason, because their background makes them ideal for the story that's being told.
Isn't that interesting? And that is that's true in everybody's life, I think. No matter what they do, mm-hmm. whether they're writing, whether they are a mechanic, whether mm-hmm. you're a garbage collector, regardless of what you do, your life is special, and mm-hmm. you are living it the way that if you live your best life, you're doing it in a way that is pleasing and is also good for humanity and good for each other.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. Every person is given a vision if they want it, right? We all have the opportunity to be given a vision. Now, when we're given that vision, our natural inclination is to look for everybody else for confirmation whether we're the right person or not, right? We go to our mom, we go to our spouse, and we go to our brothers and sisters, and we go to our friends, and we go to our kids. And we say, look, I've got this great vision. And we expect that they're going to support it. And we think that they're going to support us. And what happens instead is that they're like, oh, that's crazy. Yeah, that's a crazy idea. That's a dumb idea. You shouldn't do that. So 50 million reasons why we shouldn't. And if we listen to them, we'll quit on the vision. Because we don't trust it yet. We don't understand it. But that vision was specifically given to us. The only people who can see that vision is literally us. It's not until we believe in that vision enough and trust it enough and have confidence in it enough and begin to build on that vision that other people will catch on and start to see what we see.
It's you are right. You are absolutely right, because, like, as an example, this podcast, which has been 16 years in the making, when I first started this a long, long time ago, nobody thought that it was a good idea. And it turned out that it had a degree of failure in it, and it wasn't a horribly good idea at the time, but everything has been pointing to this moment for me my entire life. This is exactly what I'm meant to do. This is who I am meant to have people like you on the show, because other people need to hear what you have to say. That's why I'm here.
Yeah. And well, I started trying to build a business at the age of 4. Okay. That's when I got my vision for a business. Now, it wasn't a specific business at the time.
It was a lemonade stand.
No, actually I tried a lemonade stand, and the glass lemonade pitcher met the hot Texas sidewalk, and you can imagine the disaster that ensued. And I blamed my brother for it because I thought he'd set down the pitcher too hard. I didn't know anything about physics.
Oh, your poor brother. He was scarred for life.
Oh, well, actually, I beat the crap out of that kid. I was a terrible big sister. I was really awful to him. Poor guy. But, you know, I probably prepared him for handling bullies in life.
There you are. Yeah, big sister. My big sister was a bit of a bully, too. But, you know, we all survived, and now we're the best of friends now.
Oh, I wish I could say the same was true in our family.
I'm sorry.
And I have, my life took a direction that he couldn't follow. And he couldn't understand why I went the direction I did. And so it caused a division between us. But I have confidence that eventually in time he will see the wisdom of the direction that I took.
And the direction you took was?
Was to choose relationships over money.
Ah. But yeah. Now hold on a second, because the thing is that when you choose relationships over money, you'll have both.
Eventually. But not in the beginning.
Oh, certainly not. But at the same time, you're doing something. See, here's the thing. I'm going to get on my soapbox now. Money is the root of all evil. It can be if it's not used appropriately. And if you are simply after money, when you're 95 and you're on your deathbed and you have no relationships and you're counting your dollars, it's not going to matter because you can't take it with you anyway.
Yeah. Well, it was my son, really, that kind of caused me to take a total redirection of my life. You want to talk about a moment where you have a confrontation with the way that you've been living. He was 2 months from his 7th birthday, standing there in my bedroom, looking me in the eyes, telling me not only that he was going to kill himself, but he knew exactly how he was going to do it, and he had a backup plan in case that first plan didn't work.
Oh, my God.
That's exactly what I said. And I asked myself, how did we get to this point where we broke this baby so badly that death was preferable to life? And it was that journey of finding the answer to that question that ultimately led me to the conclusion that money is just a tool. But when you make that money the obsession of your life, and when it becomes your first priority, it's a wonderful servant. It's a terrible tyrant of a god.
You know, you should write a book.
I keep getting told.
you have a talent for putting words together.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. That's why I use that talent mostly for other people's benefit, because that pays and that keeps bills paid. And I'm working on my story, but it does slow down the process when I'm also working on other people's stories.
Well, yeah. but you will get there. You'll get to where you will be able to put that down and in a really heartfelt way. Because I'll tell you, in our society, and I don't know about other societies because I haven't lived in them, but in our society, suicide, depression, fear, it's rampant in our society, and we really have to decide that there's another way.
We do have to decide that there's another way. And actually, you know, at the beginning of October, I felt this calling in my soul that I was being asked to learn to live without money. And I thought it was just a personal thing. I thought it was just me being told, try living without money. And I really was like horrified sort of by that thought, which then led me to the conclusion that, oh my gosh, I'm way more addicted to money than I realized. So I had to rethink, well, what would it be like if we were in a world without money? And I realized, you know, the truth of the matter is that if we operated from a place where we traded, the currency of preference was love and service, wouldn't that change the whole world?
Instantly.
Okay. Think about this. Out of 7 billion people on the planet, I guarantee you that somebody out there has whatever it is you need today. And if they knew you, and they knew how much you loved them, and they knew that everything that you did was going to benefit them in some way, wouldn't they be happy to share?
You would think. You would hope.
Yeah. Well, I mean, if they saw the benefit of sharing it with you would be something that came back to them greater than what they'd given to you, then most people will be happy to share. What the reason that we don't share is that we're afraid it's not going to come back to us.
That's true. You know, I kind of get that all the time. is like, you know, I want to share people with the world. I want to share you with the world. There's a certain segment of my friends and stuff that say, well, oh,
sorry,
was that you?
Yeah, apparently it's me causing Facebook notification, I think.
Oh, okay. But they're like, you know, and when I was doing the radio show years ago, it was like, well, you know, you need to charge these people. You need to make money. You need to charge these people for that. And I said, I don't want to, because I want them to, I want it to be honest and frank and authentic. And mm-hmm. You can't do that if, you know, everybody, if you're paying me $50 to be a writer for, or a teaching writing to somebody, then if you're paying me money, then you are suddenly the best there is ever in the world. And I didn't want that.
Exactly.
I didn't want that to be the case. I wanted it to be authentic and real. And money is not, money doesn't get you where you want to go. It's you're right.
Well, no, money has many uses, but what it does not do are many things. Money will not be there in the nursing home with you, holding your hand, visiting you.
Yeah.
Money will not be in the hospital with you, holding your hand when you're dying and taking your last breath. It will not be there. If you have not invested in building relationships with the people around you, they will not be there. One of the things I've done as I've ghostwritten is talked to a lot of really wealthy people, and many, many, many of them built their businesses telling themselves, well, I'll invest in my relationship when my business is successful. I'll take that time out when my business is successful. They got to the top, they looked down, and they realized, wait a minute, where are all those people I was building this business for? They're gone. Because you cannot put people on a shelf and expect them to stay there. They don't work like that. While you're out there building your business, ignoring them, they're going to do what people do. They're going to fill in the gap. They're going to put people and relationships in place of the one that you could have had.
Which makes it a very sad ending for somebody.
Well, it does. Yeah, many of these people that I talked to, they were like, when I went and got to the top, there was nobody that I could trust around me. All the people that I knew were people who were there, and I couldn't tell if they were there for me or there for my money.
That's true, because people are at the end of the day, when your ideal is to make money and solely to make money, when you are in that process, you tend, the people that care for you genuinely tend to fall away, because you don't care for them, because you're interested in climbing to the top. So you put people around you that can get you to the top and all that, and then after you get to the top, the people that genuinely cared about you or have gone on to other things because they figure you didn't care about them, right?
Exactly. You know, you have to choose where you invest your life. You don't get to choose how much time you have, but you do get to choose where you invest it. And you need to think about, where am I investing it? Am I really investing it in the most important places? Because yes, providing nice things for your kids is good, but it is not what they really need.
No.
That is one thing I learned from my child, and that in that moment of confronting his suicidal tendencies was I had been penciling him in between work and school and everything else that I was busy doing. He didn't need the money. He didn't need me to be super educated. What he needed was for me to be super present.
And to give him love.
Exactly. And he also needed a community. This was one thing my husband and I, both of us grew up and we didn't really know how to trust people. So we had isolated ourselves. Well, the result of isolation is that our son was isolated. He had no friends at home that he could go play with. He had very few friends at school. He was being bullied and I didn't know it. And so as a consequence, the kid was dying for lack of love. And not that I didn't love him, not that his father didn't love him, not that people didn't love him, but love in a way that he could understand and process. Because just because you love somebody doesn't mean the way that you're communicating it is processing for them.
The perception that they have mm-hmm. is everything. Because if they...
Well, everybody receives love differently.
Correct.
And so you have to know that, you have to connect with that person enough, enter their world, and know how they receive love to be able to communicate it effectively.
There's a book called The Five Love Languages. Have you read that?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I have actually. And he's on to something. You know, there are a lot of people who do not receive love the same way you do. And to assume that you do is like assuming that everybody sees exactly what you see when they look at something.
By the way, Gary Chapman is the author of The Five Love Languages. And if you would like to listen to his interview, I interviewed him, and it is on my Independent Report. So,
oh, awesome. I'll have to go dig for that. Yeah.
So it would be a, it's a real fun episode. Because I've got, you know, like 90 of those things up now, and a lot, there's some, you know, Brandy, you are typical of the type of guest that I love to have on, because you are so smart and you are so gifted and you are so positive, and you have something to say, and I am just really glad that I can provide you with a forum to be able to say it.
Well, I appreciate that. That means a lot to hear. Actually, the funny thing is, it was my brother they thought was mentally retarded, so they IQ tested him when he was in third grade and discovered that he was like well above the genius level. But nobody thought that I was that bright. I mean, I was in the advanced reading classes, but I didn't excel in math, so they didn't see my intelligence the same way. And for a long time, I didn't really see myself as that smart. I knew I was okay smart, but not really smart.
Well, but you know, there are differences as far as being smart. You can have a high IQ and be dumber than a stick when you're talking to people, and because they have no idea what it's like to build a relationship or to look into somebody's eyes and to look into their soul to get an idea of who they are and what they are about, and to connect with that individual. That's a different type of talent that you have, and so it doesn't matter. You don't have to be necessarily really book smart to be who you really are. You are just a genuine person who cares about people.
I do. Actually, I decided at the age of 32, I came into work. That day I was just about in tears by the time I got to work. I was reflecting on all the things I didn't have in life. I was reflecting on the fact that I didn't have a car. I didn't have a house. I didn't have a degree. I didn't have a title. I didn't feel significant at all. I felt like I was so unimportant in the world. And I prayed and I said, just give me something, something to lean on, something to make myself feel better. And I open up to scripture and there it is. It's foxes have dens and birds of the air have nests, but the Son of Man has nowhere to rest his head. Now, I was working in a marketing department for a Fortune 500 company that routinely spends $2 billion a year on advertising. Huh. And I had to ask myself, would I consider Jesus to be a failure as a human being? Because he didn't have a house. He had to borrow the ass on which he rode into Jerusalem. He didn't have a place to live. He didn't have a job. He didn't have a title. He didn't have a degree. The Pharisees kept questioning him, well, who gave you your title? He's like, my father. So he really didn't have all of the status markers the society uses to judge whether or not somebody's important.
Right.
And yet, I would consider him a massively wildly successful marketer, wouldn't you? I mean, come on, 2,000 years after the guy's dead, we're still singing his jingles, reading his books.
Yeah, he did. He did well. He figured that part out.
He spread it over the entire globe. He took what was essentially a mom and pop organization and turned it into the most successful multi-level marketing organization ever heard. With the everybody reach one, teach one.
Yes, indeed. And
he pioneered the method. And because of that, there is not a single continent where his name has not been heard.
That's right.
But he started with 12 people who were living in the backwaters of Jerusalem, of Israel, not even Jerusalem, backwaters of Israel, in the Roman kingdom, right? The least significant place on the planet. That's where he pulls his disciples from. So if there's a lesson to be learned in that, it is that, and so I decided, you know, if he was successful, and I would definitely consider him successful at what he did, well, then what did he base his success on? And I realized if you read through scripture, it's evident he worked very hard on cultivating relationships with every person he connected to. It was all about the relationship with them, about knowing them on a deep personal level.
That's true.
And I decided... I thought about that, and at the time, Howard Hughes was still alive, and I was like, you know, would I consider Howard Hughes to be successful, Mr. Playboy? No, I would not, because he built his success on by demeaning people, by presenting them as objects to be used rather than people to be given dignity and value. And so then I asked myself, well, if he lost everything today, who would be there to help him rebuild? Would the bunny still be there on the ranch?
Nope. He'd be by himself.
Exactly. He'd be all by himself because, you know, he built it by using people as tools to build his wealth.
And that's never a good idea.
No, it's not. And so I decided then and there that I would build it the way that Jesus built it, which was on relationships, which doesn't mean that everybody will always be there to help you. I mean, if you look at it on the cross, he was deserted by his followers, except for two people, his mom and the youngest of the disciples. Those are the only two people still sticking around. Everybody else left.
That's it. That's because they saw what was going on and that wasn't pretty. So they were scared.
So just because you give that way and just because you build your life on relationships doesn't mean that everybody is going to always be there for you when you need them. And you need to be real about that. But it does mean that every relationship will go through cross and crucifixion moments, followed by a period when it feels like it's completely dead, only to be followed by a resurrection and a glorification. So that was the message ultimately of the cross, is that if you can love people past that moment where they desert you and leave you hanging on the cross, and you can ride out that period where the relationship feels dead, on the other side of that is a glory and a resurrection coming. The relationship will be renewed. It will be in a totally different place than you've ever seen it before.
And it's something that you can do. We can all choose. And there again, it's everything's a choice. And it's you can choose to, you know, I was in sales for a long time, and we preached relationship selling. You build a relationship with somebody, and then you can, but you can't lie to them at the same time. And if you're going to build a good relationship, you can't be a sales guy. You have to be an honest broker. And, and that's,
or a confidant, consultant.
Exactly. And somebody,
who's in there for the best interest. Well, what I say to people about sales is that it's really nothing more than an invitation that you are issuing to another person to walk with them in helping them achieve their dreams. The reason most people fail in sales is that they can't let go of their own dreams long enough to do that.
That's true.
They're looking at people as a stepping stone to get to their dreams. And nobody wants to be used. So the minute that somebody feels like they're being used, they're going to back away.
Yep.
The only people you're going to get if you're selling like that are people who are equally looking to use you.
And that's
so you're
going
to hate the people you work with. Right? If you get them as clients, you'll hate them because they're icky people in their behavior.
And that's
they may be good people underneath, but they're icky in their behavior. So if you can let your dreams die and focus on their dreams and helping them achieve those dreams, then you won't have any problems with it.
And that, my dear, is how you are building your business, isn't it? By helping other people. As a matter of fact, I wanted to get, you know, we're still on the air, but I wanted to get your advice on something, if you don't mind.
Absolutely.
I've been doing this podcast. I've been doing, you know, radio for a long time. And so I've got the tools. I know how to do the editing. I've got the thing, and I'm going to open up a business, and the business is going to be, it's called KM Radio Productions, and it's going to be about creating and educating people on how to do a podcast and then producing it for them and with them. Do you think that's a good idea?
Oh, I think it's a great idea, and I think it's a perfect time to launch that business.
Aha. Well, so there, how come?
Because we're going to be moving to a virtual economy. We can't help but move to a virtual economy, right? With everybody being isolated, they're going to be bored. In fact, if you're investing right now, now's the ideal time to be investing in entertainment stocks. Anything that's American made and entertainment is where I would put my money.
Oh, I think that's really good because I've got
education, entertainment, online, anything is really going to be big because people are going to be bored out of their gourd. Let's face it.
That is so true. That is so true. Because what I'm finding is that there aren't a lot of people that can do the technical side and can also do the entertainment side. And
it's true.
I think I can do both. What do you think? Am I okay?
No, I think you're in a good position. You've got a proven track record that helps. You can show them what you've done. You can show them what you're able to do. So they know you can do the work. And then on top of that, you have the skills. So people buy to get results. That's the only reason they buy. They want to know, what can you do for me? And can you prove that you can do it?
That is so true.
And if you can prove that you can do it, they will buy. If you prove that you can do it and you can show them the value of having done for them, that's, you have to be able to paint the picture of what their life is going to be like when that podcast is done. And that's where you having those guests that they're able to reach out to, right? The fact that you were able to get somebody who's a best-selling author on your show to talk to you and open up to you. You know, people love to be linked to celebrities. I was able to get a celebrity makeup artist to talk to me because I was interviewing her for a fashion magazine.
Right.
So when you have a piece that is going to help them, they're more than willing to come talk to you and open up to you.
Oh, exactly. Well, I even last week, last Tuesday, John Edward, the psychic medium, was on.
Mm-hmm.
And he, you know, so I've interviewed people like Gary Zukav and Neil Donald Walsh and coaches and a lot of different folks. And I think you're right. So I'm going to embark upon this business model.
I totally encourage you to do that. And if you need my support, I'm more than willing to help and lend it to you.
You're awesome. You're awesome. So
I firmly believe that if we work together as a society to help everybody succeed, then we don't have to have the economic crisis looming on the horizon collapse on us. We can all ride the wave.
I agree.
Rather than drowning in the aftermath.
That's exactly right. By the way, you know, we've been talking for 80 minutes.
Well, I do apologize, but I am going to have to go because I promised somebody that I would be talking to them shortly.
It is time.
Fantastic being with you.
It is fantastic being with you. Now, but first of all, Brandy M. Miller has been our guest. She's got the book, which is entitled
Turning Problems into Profits.
Turning Problems into Profits, and she can be reached by...
You can reach me at email at brandy@theopportunityprospector.com. And my website is theopportunityprospector.com. You can also find me on Facebook. It's Brandy M. Miller 1975. If you want to send me a friend request, I've got a few slots open. I'm on Twitter @writerbrandy. You know, just I'm pretty much out there. I'm pretty easy to find.
Well, then that makes you a gold mine if you're easy to find. So we thank you for being on the show, Brandy, and we're going to have you back again because you're pretty awesome. You know that? So with that.
Well, thank you. I appreciate that. You're pretty awesome too.
Well, thank you very much. We're going to wrap this up and you take care. Have a great day, everybody.
And you too. Have a great day.
Bye-bye.
Bye.
Hey, and thanks for listening to this episode all the way to the end. Hey, pretty cool. Hey, don't forget to follow us so you can receive regular updates and new posts. And remember, take care of each other because each other's all we've got. See you next time on My Independence Report.